Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, the 13th of September, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Evelyn String. Today's session number is 99-1 and is titled, Mrs. Martin Luther, Why Celebrate Katie's Birthday? Let's listen in.
I was sitting next to a staff person this morning whose mother does the Minnesota and goes around to different churches and does presentations like that. And I have a friend in Texas, Sue Sappenfield, who does excellent impersonations of Katie from the writers. That is not my gift. So in case you were looking for impersonations, you're not going to get it. You still have to leave. All right. How did I get into this? Well, in 1983, I did, as many others did, go to East Germany, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, DDR, for Luther's 500. Anybody else? I met people there I knew from elsewhere. I've made the statement, all the Lutherans who could with their dogs. No dogs went there that year for Luther's 500. And the reason it was partly celebrated there was because the East Germans knew that all the Luther places like Erfurt, Eisleben, Wittenberg, all of these good spots were on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and they needed capital. And so the DDR, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, knew a good thing when they saw it. And so they really made a very big thing of Luther. I mean, they had Luther signs all over the place. If you were there, you know that. I found this book in the library. And this comes out of East Germany that was done at the time. And of course, they put their own political slant on Luther. Just to quote, Luther was the son of a small early capitalist mine owner. So he is descended from the rising bourgeoisie, the class of the future. Also, Luther's ideas were to mold the future of his class, and so on. So they did see Luther in their political context, and they made a good deal of it. And there's a lot of Luther that is very sympathetic to the poor peasants and things like that. So that's obvious. I have been back to that area since. It is a lot more calmed down at Wittenberg. Also, if any of you happen to be Lutherans who read the Lutheran, you know that there have been articles recently, Pioneer Woman of the Reformation. This is from the Lutheran of, June 1999. Anybody admit to reading the Lutheran? Okay. This is an ecumenical community, so don't feel bad if this isn't your thing, but are any of you perhaps women of the ELCA? You've heard about what? Katie's Fund, haven't you? Katie's Fund? Uh-huh. Okay, so those are some of the things that you recognize that this year we're sort of looking at Katie's because it is her 500th. Well, the reason I really got into this was because, her brokering?
Yes.
Her brokering, who is, hymn writer, poet. One of the things he did was one of the books that's in the library, A Pilgrimage to Luther's Germany, where her brokering went with Roland Baton, and these are some of Brokering's pictures and things like that. Brokering has a new book on Luther's prayers. Not that the prayers are new, but it's edited. It's in the bookstore, things like that. Brokering is an old family friend, and he called and asked, would I lead a pilgrimage to Katie's homeland in honor of Katie Luther's birthday party? So I thought I'd better bone up on Katie. I'm not advertising this because the trip is full. I mean, so, it's not an ad. I mean, but this information was fairly widely circulated in Seeds of the Parish and things like that. So I am under obligation, if I'm supposed to lead this group, to know a little bit more about Katie Luther. And that's what I've been doing. And so The idea is maybe to share a few things that I've learned, and many of you may know much more about her than I do, and I hope you will have a chance to share with that. And but that is my role as a learner who is going to accompany other people on a sort of a pilgrimage, which is not a tourist thing, but Herb Brogren likes to use the term pilgrimage, and I have been on pilgrimage with him also, woman to woman kind of thing, which we did, where one goes to learn, but not to worship, but to know more maybe about Katie's Christ, as Herb Brogren is putting it. New Luther books are still being written. Timothy Lowell, a professor at PLTS, that's a new one, that's more or less putting together writings. I was delighted to find that Bainton's paperback, this is now in paperback, Here I Stand. Roland Bainton, who was a Yale scholar, the original hardback, which I have, of course, is the copyright of that, was 1955. And this has gone through many, many editions. If you don't have Bainton's Here I Stand in paperback, the print is a little small, but it's a lot cheaper. That it's $11.95 here. I borrowed this copy from the bookstore. They have some more. But new books, even paperbacks and things like that, are being written about Luther. Now, Bainton does have a good chapter about Katie Luther. Roland Bainton was at Holden Village in 1971, and the other day I listened to the tape of his lecture on Katie. The transcription, I mean the recording, is not real good. You lose the first part, but it must have been delightful to hear Bainton in person. And the tape is in the tape library under Bainton 1971. And Bainton is one of the writers who does say something about Katie.
How do you spell Bainton?
B-A-I-N-T-O-N.
Okay.
Roland Bainton. That's still pretty much, I think, the classic on Luther books. Here I Stand. The thing that makes this book more expensive also in the hardback is it a very rich resource of old prints, illustrations, and you see in the paperback also. So you have many, many illustrations that, and it's not just print. So that's really a good one. But he does justice to Katie, and in fact the chapter in which he focuses on her is The School for Character, chapter 17, which is sort of interesting. I was poking around the library here to see what we have in Luther books and anything on Katie, and interesting, I found this. Catherine von Bora, Dr. Martin Luther's wife, the copyright on this book is 1890.
Wow.
So it's not all new, over 100 years. And those of you who know Old Village Connection, it is a gift from the old Augustana Luther League from Wilfred Bergstrom. You might, any of you may know, may remember that connection. There are a number of those. And there have been other books written even 100 years ago about Katie, only, and many, some since. There was one called Katie My Rib, which some of you may have read, and I've lost my copy, I don't know where it is. But there is a lot that is there. So old books and new books are around, and how factual all of them are. You know, when you write a more or less a story. Another one that I found very, very interesting is a series of, there were articles in the Walter Lee Messenger, the publication of the LCMS, and this comes out of the early 40s, and the very readable articles and seem to be very, very well done. A friend of mine who has the book loaned it to me, so I copied most of it. I mean, you know, as old as that is, nobody's going to worry about it, I guess. It's for my benefit. All right. Any comments there on references, resources? And I'm alert along with you. Let's look at a little bit of chronology. I think we need to get that. Well, 1483 was the year that Luther was born. This year, I understand that Wittenberg is really dolled up again. A couple of people who've been over there, including the Brogrings, have been there again this year. Herb has been there several times this year. That they're doing a lot with Katy in that area, that their big signs are up again. There's a postage stamp that I have seen that the Germany now has printed with Katie's picture. See, so there is recognition. There are souvenirs. I was given, well, Herb had sent one, a tote bag like this, only I didn't bring that one, which has Katy and Martin and it says Wittenberg. So there are all kinds of souvenirs, you know, that are being sold. So again, maybe they know a good thing for tourism, but it is being celebrated. 1499, Katy is born. All right, we are talking then about, as his wife, we'll get back in a more background kind of thing. Another thing that is close to my heart, my husband, who was Adolf Seestrain, who was professor, academic dean, but professor of theology at Texas Lutheran University for many, many years, taught a course on Luther, among other things. He had been widowed, and when he proposed to me, he reminded me that the age span between our ages was the same as Katy and Martin. And so sometimes you see that's going to be about 16 years, right? And so you think about marriages where there's an age gap. Well, how do you feel about that?
I've never been in it, so I don't know.
Well, I've always said that my marriage was made in heaven, you know, sort of. And so he thought that if it worked for Martin and Katy, it could work for us. And it surely did. And I was blessed by the 23 years we shared together. All right, that's another reason, I guess, why this sort of touches me a little bit, you know, from that angle. I'm hearing him talk about Luther and being very much interested in that. All right, let's talk a little bit about Katy and her background. And I may refer to notes off and on. You probably know that Catherine von Bora, that the von Bora tells you what, V-O-N. A little bit of nobility in there, right. So her parents were of some nobility, but they were poor. And her mother died when she was five. So the father marries again, but you know, how do things work? Well, they put her at five into a convent school for which you pay tuition. And then it's apparent, after a certain number of years, they couldn't afford the tuition anymore. So that's when she went into the convent at Nimschen, which is in this same area kind of thing. It's not far from Leipzig. And so perhaps going to a convent school was not that unusual, but then going into a convent in terms of young women, well, I think that Ruth, who does the medieval things, would be able to tell us much more about that.
I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you know if they had to pay a dowry to get into the cloister? Do you have that information?
I have not read that anyplace on how much they paid. But the convent that she went into was one only for daughters of nobility.
Oh. Almost all were.
Yeah, there was supposed to be about 50 young women. Yeah. And so the idea was that, well, all right, this time in Germany, okay, what's Germany? It's not Germany yet. It's all these feudal states. So you've got these feudal states and these princes who like to war with each other or guard their turf or something like that. So it's an unsettled time. If you have a lot of warring, you're going to have men killed. You're going to have sort of a shortage of men, right? So that marriageable men are not real easy to come by in all cases. So you've got time of unrest. There was even some peasant revolt sort of beginning around this time. But anyway, in 1505, okay, now that's Martin. The dark is Martin.
Yeah.
When did Martin go into the cloister? At what age? 1705. He was in his 20s, right? He was
in,
you remember the story of how Martin decided to become a monk and so on. His father wanted him to do what?
Be a lawyer.
Okay. So we've got, I'm just putting Martin's parallel there. So Katie at 1515 about, at age 16, after she's been a novice or something in the convent, takes the veil. What does that mean?
She
now takes her vows at about what age then?
16.
Some references will have it vary by a year or so. I've read 15, but around 16. So she is in the convent. And the story of that is that the background, if you read about that, life is very strict. They would have an abbess. And this particular abbess for the convent at Nimshin was supposed to be rather uptight about regulations and things. They did not have much free time at all. If they transgressed some of the rules, it might be bread and water and isolation and things like that. What in the world did they do? There was a lot of handwork, stitching, because you've got all these relics that were maybe the property of this particular convent. So you might have to have something fancy to cover the relics. This is the one that says, what did she do? Fine needlework, altar cloths with fine laces, embroidered mass robes, fine covers for the 367 precious relics on the 12 altars. Like there were pieces of Christ's crib, of the cross, of the crown of thorns, of the pillar at which he was scourged, of his communion table, of his handkerchief. There was earth from the Mount of Olives where Christ wept over Jerusalem, of Mount Calvary, of his grave, of the place where he ascended into heaven. They had pieces of the Virgin's veil. I mean, Ruth has talked about that. Shirt, dress, and hairs. I mean, you name it. So these things weren't just lying out in the open. They would have to be in fancy containers. So very well, very likely, Catherine did things like that. Well, you know the story that, all right, look at what Luther is doing. And he's posted the 95 theses on the door at Wittenberg. And the original door is not there anymore. They've replaced it with a bronze or something in which they copied 95 theses. Somebody probably has a piece of the original wooden door.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure.
And you've got then publications, because Luther was writing and writing and writing. The theses, of course, were for debate. And so what some of the things he's writing about is questioning the monastic life, whether that is really the best holy way to serve God, and also certainly questioning all this relic business and the practices of the church, but really wondering about the way the monasteries and the convents have gathered riches, and is that really the holy life? So this writing sort of leaks into some of the places. I mean, this is not that far from Wittenberg. And then also the idea of the diet of worms, where Luther then has to be protected, you know, the Wartburg and all of that, and where he's a heretic. And in his time, he's translating Psalms. Well, but he was writing prolifically, and the writings were circulated. They didn't have television, newspapers, but the writings got around. What was the printing press?
There's a printing press.
Yeah, 14.
88?
Gutenberg.
Gutenberg. Yeah, Gutenberg. Yeah.
So, what year?
This is the 1400s.
1400s, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you see, they could, it wasn't like, you know, books necessarily, but like sheets, you know, broad sheets that they circulated kind of thing. So some of these things got into the convent also. So that as different writers tell it, there may have been a group of 8 or 12, some say 12, some say 8, others say 9, of the nuns who really were hearing Luther and were not feeling that comfortable in the convent anyway. It wasn't their idea. I mean, a lot of them got in there as children. It wasn't their decision later on that this is what I really want to do with my life. So there they are. And as some of the writers tell it, that some of them sort of got together and talked about how can we get out of here or something, and so they wrote letters to parents who were surviving. Mm-hmm. We really would like to, you know, get out. This doesn't seem right for us. And of course that didn't work, because in some cases that really got them into trouble. And so as various stories have it, that Luther himself may have helped to arrange for some of them to get out. Now that's told in interesting story fashion. This 1890 book talks about it. The merchant, Leonard Coppi, who regularly brought, you might say, grocery delivery to the convent, good man, and had his nephew and so on, was apparently a friend of Luther's, and so some arrangement was made. As this story tells it, he brought his nephew, and he knew that the abbess was very, very strict, and but he knew that she was scared of screech owls. So he had his nephew imitate a screech owl, that she would sort of go under hiding and not be listening around to what was happening. Well, you can put a lot of fiction around this, whether there is any truth or not, but it makes an interesting story. How did they keep the abbess from knowing that some of these young women were escaping?
The abbess, what was her position?
The abbess would be the administrator, the head person of the convent. Would you define that better for us, Ruth?
Well, was actually one who passed on the rules. The abbess would have been under the bishop,
okay,
and responsible for whatever was going on in the nunnery.
And this was Dominicans, I think.
She wasn't the mother superior, though.
Well, if you saw the sound of music, would that be comparable? Mother superior, the sound of music, probably comparable.
Yeah.
But names changing, you know, kind of thing over the period of time. All right. Anyway, you know the story of how some of them got out? Now, was it 9 or was it 12? I don't know. Whatever. What's the story?
Pickled herring.
Right. That Leonard, the friend of Luther, who regularly made deliveries, came with these big barrels that had herring in them, and this was on Easter Eve. On Easter Eve, when things would be pretty quiet anyway, and that he hid them under what we would call a tarp, kind of thing, and was able to get out. Now the thing was that this convent was in the area of Prince George. Who was not a friend of Luther's. So had they gotten caught, it might have been very severe punishment. In fact, some other person who tried to free nuns from the convent was later on put to death for that. So, I mean, there are stories like that. In fact, Luther, I think, wrote a letter or story about the death of a about his death and what a righteous deed that was, that he was freeing the women from the convent. So it was happening all over, and you know, words were getting around.
So they would, the nuns would get in the barrels, and then
were in the barrels, probably, or under the tarp with the barrels on the old wagon, jogging over what roads they had. They would have been pretty badly bruised had they been
underneath the
barrels, so maybe they were in the barrels. That is not real clear. But it was on a load with salted herring barrels, which, yeah, kind of, as far as we know. All right. And so what does he do with them? He brings them to Luther, who had been writing these things. And the idea then, the escape, Easter Eve, April 5th, 1523, they kept the Easter vigil. This book says, 9 of them slipped out and were packed like so many herrings into the covered wagon. So, you know, in the barrel or out, probably in. Of the 60-year-old Leonard Coppe, K-O-P-P-E, who risked his life to aid them. This says 9, others will have up to 12, whatever. But they were delivered then and brought safely to Wittenberg on Easter. What a morning. Brought them to what is called the Black Cloister. Now, the Black Cloister is not black. It's in Wittenberg. The building still stands. That's where Luther was sort of keeping house, he wasn't keeping house, but that's where he was living, and that's where some students were living also. And it was, there must have been, rooms of different sizes. It was called the Black Cloister because the monks who had lived there had worn black clothes, right? But the building itself is white, as you may remember, with a little black trim or something like that around the window. So anyway, that's where they were delivered.
So is Luther still a priest this time, or had he left the priesthood by this time?
He is preaching in the church at Wittenberg, definitely. And he is, although he had been excommunicated, oh, yeah. I mean, he is preaching in the church in Wittenberg.
But there's still a Catholic bishop.
But his elector, or the person who is in charge of the political unit there, Frederick the Wise, okay, is a friend of his.
So that may be the only place they can preach.
Well, yeah, or other places that are friendly, if he can get there.
Yeah.
If he can get there without trouble. And, you know, there were sometimes real troubles of getting someplace, because you could get kidnapped along the way or something like that. All right. So the idea was that Luther earlier had written a sermon on marriage and so on, and said that marriage was a good estate, and he didn't see that the celibate life was commanded in scriptures at all. I mean, you can find that in Luther's works and Luther's sermons. And so the story then that they found husbands for some of these younger women. Let's see, how old would Katie have been? Escaped from the convent, 1523. She was 24 when she escaped. All right. Now, there wasn't anybody around for Katie right away, so you will find different versions of where she stayed. She went into a home and learned about a lot of domestic science, which she probably had not had in the convent. Because there she was probably doing more of the needlework and things like that. So we're pretty sure that she was in the house of Philip and Elsa Reichenbach. And he was sort of a mayor or something like that, and where she was a very hard worker and really doing a lot of the, learning about housework and things like that. There's a charming story in this book, which may or may not be true, that Luther would come to visit the Reichenbachs, And that Luther one time commented that his servant had reported that there was supposed to be baked fish still in the, wherever they kept it, cool. Well, in that climate, it was probably cool anyway. But the cat had gotten it. And so this writer has Catherine hearing the conversation that Luther is living very poorly, has barely enough of the necessities of life on his professor's salary, and is giving all his money away. And so Catherine wraps a piece of the smoked meat that they had for dinner and slips it over to Luther to take, so since the cat ate the fish. Well, you read all kinds of neat little stories like that that may have some basis in fiction or not. But while Katie was there, either in the home of the Reichenbachs or later in the home of Lucas Cranach, who is the famous artist, and apparently she was there later, and some people have her with the Reichenbachs the whole time, so whatever. Anyway, there is a young man who's a student out of Nuremberg, but he is in Wittenberg at the university, and he is interested in Katie. And it's pretty clear that they fall in love. One writer says she fell violently in love. I don't like that. That's a bad word. I mean, fall violently. But anyway, they fell in love. And everybody assumed that, all right, she would marry Jerome Baumgartner. Now, he had to go back home to Nuremberg. And she didn't hear, and she didn't hear, and she didn't hear. And in fact, her hosts reported to Martin, who felt responsible for all of these nuns that he had helped to get out. And so Luther wrote a letter someplace that said, you know, if you don't come soon, she's going to be pledged to somebody else. You know, after a year and a half, she hadn't heard. Well, you know, was her heart broken? I mean, the evidence is that she really liked this young man, but his father had other ideas. And to marry a nun who would be under the edict of the Pope and dangerous and had no money. And so this young man married a 14-year-old girl who had money. So anyway, that was that. Well, by this time, Luther is getting a little concerned about Katie, and so are others. So he has somebody else that he proposes. Important person at the university, the rector of the university, who's also a preacher. And oh boy, he should be all right, shouldn't he? But he says, no way. Mm-hmm. No? Yes.
I always think back to the Martin Luther film that was produced in the 50s.
Yes.
And I've always thought it was such a beautiful transition in which they have the scene in which Martin Luther is saying to Katie, "We have to find a husband for you." "Yes, Dr. Luther." "We have to find a husband for you." "Yes, Dr. Luther." "We have to find a husband for you." "Yes, Dr. Luther." The next scene is they're standing before the minister.
Thank you. Yeah, I wonder if it's still possible to get that film.
Oh yeah, it's still.
It's been years.
There are highlights of it that you can get.
All right, it's been years since I've seen it. Yeah, this was Dr. Kaspar Glatz, rector of the university, and also wealthy, who courted Kate. But she just couldn't take to the man and said no. Luther says Luther was very much put out with her and thought she was a little uppish. Well, Katie was getting a little worried here. You know, what's going to happen to her? Is she always going to be sort of a house servant? Although, on the other hand, she's learning a lot about domestic life, which she didn't learn before. And so that she goes to Amsdorf, who's a good friend of Luther, and begs him to you know, she's not talking to Luther, but to keep Luther from forcing her on Glatz and Amsdorf reports that to Luther. And then so Glatz didn't turn out right anyway. And so Amsdorf asked, isn't a doctor good enough for you? And Katie said, well, if asked by you or Luther, I would not say no. The way this has. Well, Amsdorf apparently remained a bachelor, but Luther, being sort of confronted with the idea, decided, okay. Now, according to what I've read in different places, they were betrothed the same day as he proposed. And betrothal in those days, the betrothal was the 13th of June, 1525, with Bugenhagen and was it Amsdorf, somebody else, I tell you.
The expression used sometimes for a man in that situation, he was like a deer caught in the headlights.
Oh, very good. Was that what the 13th of
June? Well, this was 1525, but the 13th of June was when the proposal was, is that it? The proposal, I mean, the engagement officially, which they sanctified in front of an altar. Bugenhagen was one, and who was the other one? Okay. Anyway, that was taken very seriously. I mean, the concept then of betrothal or engagement, and our engagement idea nowadays is quite different, right?
Oh,
yeah. And so the betrothal or the engagement was like marriage. In other words, you did not yet live together, but it was if you went with somebody else. That was considered adultery because you had made the vow for that person. So 2 weeks later, there was the official wedding. 2 weeks later, and Luther wrote the wedding invitations and included his parents got to come to that. None of Katie's relatives got to come, whether they were too poor or what or anything like that. And you can find descriptions, I think, in Bainton and others of how that was really done with a real sort of procession through town with musicians to the church and things like that. And the wedding breakfast and then the meals, they're all described and they're all pretty well recorded. I mean, that is not entirely all imagination. Now, we might say, why had Luther resisted marriage before that really, you know, was he the deer in the headlights kind of thing or what? Why would he have resisted marriage earlier when he was saying people really should get married?
He was writing.
He's too busy.
He had trouble probably supporting himself. He didn't have a household probably. I'm thinking.
Why else might he resist marriage?
Well, he may have taken that part of scripture so seriously. If you can, I don't know where it is. If you can live alone, fine. But if you can't,
he was recommending it to other people, though. Think of the times.
His life was in danger.
His life was in danger. There was a price on his head. Furthermore, it was a very restless time. Around this time again, there were revolts and things like that.
Evelyn?
Furthermore, yes.
In 1139, it had been an edict of the church.
Yes.
That no priest should be married, and Martin Luther was a priest in the church.
Yeah. So he was.
He was still a priest in the Roman church?
Yeah. I mean, he could have been put to death, you know.
So his recommendations about marriage weren't really at everybody. It was for what he recommended marriage as being a good thing.
Yeah.
He was just overcoming the idea that it was second class, third class.
Yeah.
He wasn't really recommending that there not be any more
celibate
priests.
No. Well,
He was not seeing much purpose in that.
And you can read his sermons on marriage, and all those sermons are in the library. There's a very good reference in the reference library over there. And,
well, I think that's a really good point, too, that if he was a price on his head, and he didn't, not only didn't he have much money to support a wife, but he probably was thinking of a person, a wife that he would have, would be a widow.
And, yes, all right, also think of the age span.
Right.
He's how much older than she is?
16.
Sure.
All right, and a woman who was widowed in those days would have a much harder time sometimes.
Right.
So thinking that because he was older, she would have to make it alone and so on. So we can see a lot of those different things. How about Luther's health?
He wasn't well.
What do you know of Luther's health?
Bone problems.
Oh, he was not in good health. Now, some people will say that he had mood swings of depression. You can read that up and down. But that he always, I mean, when you think about the diet of the day, what they were eating then, and also Luther would work for maybe 2 days at one time, and when he was translating this, working on the Psalms, 2 days he didn't eat. In other words, he was so intense at his work, so that nothing wrong with fasting, but he would neglect his physical well-being and being cooped up someplace writing. He certainly didn't get his exercise, so he knew he was sickly. And probably Catherine knew that too. Anyway, for the wedding then, there were lots of wedding gifts, even from kings and others who supported them from other countries who had gotten the Lutheran doctrine and were buying into it. And you can still see some of those wedding gifts in museums today. Yes?
If from the time he proposed and he was engaged the same day, married 2 weeks later.
Right.
How did anybody, and you know, thinking of communication at that time, how did all these other kings and whatever even know he was getting married? I mean, 2 weeks wasn't a long time.
Yeah, that is one of the things you wondered about communication. I wondered about that too. But wedding gifts came, and maybe they had their representatives something in the area, and maybe they moved along pretty fast. That's a good question. I wondered about that.
I would bet when Martin Luther got married, that was a big deal because he was a priest.
It was a big deal.
And that was, man, gossip travels fast.
That probably went fast.
Yeah, it probably did, because one of the reasons Luther said he shouldn't get married, somebody said, if this monk had a wife, the devils would laugh and angels would weep. You know, that kind of statement was made about him. But how they found out that fast, I don't know.
Remember the culture in which he was living.
Yeah.
Students all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And right, they would be communicating back home.
Yes, they would.
But maybe some of the wedding gifts came after the wedding.
That very likely. Yeah. Very likely.
The other question is, if he was so poor, who was paying for these? This band or whatever it was, musical thing that was marching down the street.
The city. Now you can read about the wedding gifts. The city, the university, kings and so on subsidized this. And some of the wedding gifts were so impractical. I mean, they were, you know, like big golden goblets or something. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't eat them. You really can't sell them because they were a wedding gift. Now, some of the lesser things, Luther later on would give away his wedding gifts to somebody else. I mean, so there were a lot of things, but in the museums in that area, you can see some of the wedding gifts. You can also see their wedding rings. I forget whether they were at Wittenberg or what. They were heavily designed. And how did they get the wedding rings designed that fast? I don't know. I mean, I sort of wondered about that, but they're there. You can see the wedding gifts. Very, very heavy. There are pictures of these in some of these books. Okay, Luther living in the Black Cloister, or that house. Students boarding there, well, students living there, and other professors, because by this time he was a professor at the university, right? And other professors also took in students. Luther did not charge them. Maybe they were supposed to help. There was one perpetual student.
I've known the kind.
Whoever quite makes it and just sort of keeps on going to school, and you know, but no. There was one named Wolfgang, who, Wolfgang Sieberger, who was sort of his Man Friday. And one writer has said about him, his motto was, if there's anything that you can put off till tomorrow, do it. So the first job that apparently Katie had was to clean up the place. You know, you read about Luther for years. The same. I mean, that's written someplace. I mean, who changed the sheets? Well, he didn't, or whatever, you know. I mean, so to clean up the place. Some stories have Elsa Reichenbach helping her clean it up and whatnot. So that just moving into the place must have been something else. All right, here were these students. Okay, Luther got a salary, but he was always giving it away. And Katie realized, okay, someplace along the line, you've got to make ends meet. And so the idea was, well, these students have to pay room and board. Mm-hmm. And so there was some grumbling among the students, you can imagine, but they did that. All right, life here in this place, gift list. Goblets, swords, necklaces, daggers. They must have had a museum room. By the way, the proposal was June 13th. The wedding was June 27th. So that's 2 weeks, as we said. All right. And no, okay, clothing, where does it come from? You don't go to the dress shop or the clothing shop. And the food, all right, Catherine then really is a very, very industrious person. And one of the things that happens, I mean, I won't date this, her brother, she does have a brother named Hans, and there's a little bit of family land that her family had named Zielsdorf, about 2 days distance by that. And apparently it is not very good, productive, anything like that, but she feels the need really for that land, for the building something there to raise more food, also looking to the future, that her family would have a place to stay. So early on, one of the things she does is to get this land, to be able to buy this land from the brother when there's to try to afford that as a special place. But there's another part to the story here. Think of how long she was pregnant or nursing a baby. We're dealing with about almost 10 years of this time. If she wasn't pregnant, she had a little one to care for. Hans, or generally called Hans, if you know German, Johannes. And so that's, I think, where they got the Hans. All right. Elizabeth, who died at 8 months. And one of the things that Luther wrote later on, also about another death, was that he learned how tender the heart of a parent can be about the loss of a child, which he never would have understood as a celibate priest, that he could have empathy for parents who lose a child. All right, so here is this little 8 months old, then Magdalena, or Lena. She was named for Katie's aunt, Magdalena von Bora, who also came out of the convent, and who came to live with the family, Magdalena. And this was really Luther's pet, I guess, Lena, or Lenzian, as they called her, the diminutive Lenzian. And this girl died at 13, which was really a very, very much love. All right, Martin, Paul, and Margaret, named after Margareta, named after Luther's mother. So, as an aside, if anybody's interested in what happened to them, you know anything about them? John became a lawyer. Martin studied theology, didn't do great thing. Martin Jr., by the way, his birthday was November the 9th. When is Luther's birthday?
Yeah.
November the 10th, so almost on Luther's birthday, Martin. Studied theology, did something. Paul is supposed to have been the more brilliant one in the family. He became a doctor. And it is said later on, as a doctor, he had learned much from his mother, who was a very good nurse and had learned a lot. A lot of things about health from his mother, so he gave tribute to her. And Margaret married a nobleman and so on. But as far as we know, the lineal descendants of the Luthers are a little hard to track down. Many, many years ago, when I was a child in Texas, the German ambassador, this would have been in the 30s, came over to this German town, New Braunfels, a German heritage town, and his name was Hans Luther. Good, you know, and he did claim to be a sort of a lineal descendant of Martin Luther, but that's another story. We're talking about Katie, but just you'd like to know about her family. So she had all of that. She had the children. What else did she have? Boarders,
students,
and visitors from all over. Nobility, people from Denmark, people from England, people from any place who were excited about Luther. Also, then you've got things like the plague hitting at certain times. And the Black Cloister becomes a hospital practice. She nursed people. There were all kinds of sick people. There was one boarder who died in there, you know. People who were sick. It was a going and coming. And then the students, of course, and the feeding everybody. Now, how do you feed everybody? And this is where Katie's industry shows. Bainton on the tape is talking about at one time she had, 5 cows, 8 pigs, sheep, horse, 9 calves, bees, pigeons, chickens, geese, garden with peas, beans, carrots, lettuce, beets, radishes, cabbage, cucumbers, melons, and an orchard, mulberries, figs, I didn't know figs grew in Germany, it's a fig. Nuts, plums, cherries, apples. She saw to it that they acquired a little stream, access to a stream where they had fish, pike, trout, perch, and carp. This is all from Bainton and so on. So that it was amazing how she was able to keep the household afloat, because Luther would always give the stuff away. Free borders, I mean, kind of thing, and giving it away. At one time...
Did he work, or did he just do his teaching?
Yeah, and then...
And stuff?
The other thing is, Luther is not home very much. He's gone for months at a time, right? I mean, this was before it was married, but now for the Augsburg Confession, all these big meetings kind of things that they're having. Well, he's over someplace else at the meetings, and at this time he was staying in Coburg, and we have a lot of letters from that time, but he is off weeks at a time. And so she's handling all of this by herself and making decisions. And that's where some interesting correspondence comes in. Now, Katie was literate,
I mean, she could read and write. We have none of her letters. Isn't that something?
Mm.
There are about 3 volumes of Luther's letters. This is from the Romans. She's probably, yeah, except, and sometimes Luther complained that he had her. Now, you will find books. Please, you will find books that, and authors who will say, well, Luther really didn't love Catherine. I mean, you know, this was a marriage because they thought it was a good idea. And by the way, Catherine was not supposed to be beautiful. One book says she was a redhead, another one says she has black hair. I don't know. Lucas Cranach painted her, but usually when you see her, she's got this cap on. So you really don't know what color her hair was, right? Which is beside the point anyway. But the letters that Luther addresses to her. Here's one. To my kind, dear Lord, Catherine Luther, a doctor and preacher in Wittenberg. And here's another one. To my dearly beloved Catherine Luther, mistress of the house at Wittenberg, personal. And here's one. To my dear Lord, but another time, he often talked with high respect, and sometimes the mistress of Zielsdorf, his little area outside where she liked to stay, just to get away from Wittenberg. Anyway, it is pretty clear that he had high respect and love for her, even though at first it might not have been that way. Well, our time is running on here in terms of the life. Very, very difficult time. Politically, economically, the plague moves in and out. Luther's health is very, very poor. Sometimes he nearly dies. One time, the reports are he's practically dying. Katie hires some kind of a conveyance to try to take her, but in the meantime, he recovers from these kidney stones, the stone passes. And so he's able to get back. I mean, to think of her worrying. One of the stories, which may or not be true, is that he was supposed to go to Spalatin's wedding and had planned to go. And Katie had a dream that this would be very dangerous. She saw him being attacked by ruffians and killed or kidnapped or something like that, and urged him not to go. He said, oh, well, you know, I'll go anyway. And she kept pleading and pleading and had this dream that please don't go. And he listened to her and wrote his friend Spalatin that, I would grieve Katie more if I went than if I stayed here. I will grieve her too much. And later on, there was a letter from him, from Spalatin, the groom, saying, you were wise not to come because there were assassins on the way. So in that sense, I don't know, that story is not in every book, but that kind of thing. All right, Luther really depended on Katie, and she saved him from financial distress, kept it afloat. One of the stories is that Luther, when he had written the German Bible, and by the way, that's very important for the German language. German teachers will tell you that historically, the German language really as a written language got its start from Luther's German Bible. I mean, linguist. Yes, to put these things together. So Luther was encouraging Katie to read the German Bible before Easter. He even was going to pay her or something like that. And finally she balked and said, I've read enough, I know enough, would to God I lived it. And also this table talk. I mean, there's so much. You know about the table talk. These students were always taking notes, every word Luther wrote. Well, I said. And some of them would take notes in Latin, and some of them would take notes in German, and they wouldn't always agree. And Luther did not edit the notes, so you never know. But there are definitely that Katie took part in theological conversations.
In other words, she was not just Mary, Martha back in the kitchen. She was there also listening. She always called him Herr Doktor in the presence of other people. And in the German, she always said, use the Sie, which is a formal, instead of du, if you know German, du is the familiar Sie, at least in public. She always addressed him that way. But just one little note that in here, I thought it was a good, one of the letters of Luther to Katie when he's away, he says, I can't find any gifts for the children here, even though there's a fair on. I leave it to your discretion. Maybe see if you can dig up something at home for me to give them. My Lord Katie meant that she was really running things for him, saving him from financial insolvency. Well, we've got to quit, but just enough to tease you that to read some about what you can about Katie. Obviously, Luther dies, and he is not even at home at that, because he died in Eisleben. And if you go to Eisleben, they show you the room where he died. And what got me was the glass that they said, the glass he drank out of. Anyway, above his deathbed. Isn't that a little strange? But anyway, okay. So Katie is left a widow, which was not easy at that time. Luther had made his will years before. And unlike other wills, he put Katie in charge. Normally, the oldest sons would run it. That was the way you did it. He put Katie in charge of everything.
She's got 10-year-old children at that time.
Pardon me?
She's got 10-year-old children.
Yeah, yeah, but but John is coming along. Luther wrote the will, but still, he put her in charge. And that will was contested because by the time Katie died, John was in the university, you know. And she did win, but it was legal stuff she had to go through. And they said, well, she'll just take it all and deprive the children. I mean, the dirty comments that they made about her. So she had a lot of difficulty then. Then again comes war. They're going through Wittenberg. She had to flee. Wittenberg at one time was really sacked. They destroyed furniture in the Black Cloister. They killed the animals. They ravaged the gardens, stuff like that. That was earlier. She came back to that. I mean, that was after Luther's death. She came back to that, tried to again take borders. I mean, just really difficult times when the armies have been through. And then the armies come again, a wave of armies. And so she is fleeing in a carriage in a wagon towards Torgau with Margaret, who is then 18 by this time, I think. And the story is generally they agree pretty well that something scared the horses, whether it was a dog barking or whatnot, but the horses started to really bolt and be out of control. And so that Katie jumped from the wagon because maybe to control the horses, and slipped on a rock and fell in this ditch with icy water, where, I mean, she was hurt physically, but also that chill, pneumonia probably. She was sick for 2 months and died then in Torgau, where she is buried, which is not far from Wittenberg, and that is on our itinerary going to Torgau, nothing there. And her last words were recorded, Margaret was there, and the idea that I will stick to Christ as close as a burr sticks to a coat. I will stick to Christ as close as a burr sticks to a coat. Okay, when you look at that, what difference did Katie make in Luther's life? Because he had done the 95 Theses and the Here I Stand thing, I will not recant. He'd done all of that before the marriage. What difference did she make in his life?
Gave him children. Maybe kept him alive.
I think she kept them alive, because when you read how sick he was, and she would, like, for example, the food would get cold because they'd be talking, and Katie would sometimes say,
Get to it, yeah.
And somebody might fuss. I think she kept him alive. What else?
I think she brought order to his life.
Yes.
Well, isn't one of Luther's quotes, I can't quote it, of course, but he's very, that bowl of cabbage soup. She brought that kind of connection for him.
Yeah.
Even though he had his problems, in the bowl of soup, he saw everything.
And so he learned more about human beings that he could preach to, the family. I mean, what Luther did for family. Look at the catechism. Look at music. Much of the music written in the home, from Himmel hoch da komme ich her, you know, that wonderful From Heaven to Earth I Came, written for family Christmas celebration. Many of the hymns came out of that family setting, yes.
You say nothing of giving him the time away from all this other stuff of food to do all the Oxford Confession and the whole German Bible translated in just less than 6-10 years.
You really have to think.
Catechism?
Would he have made it, would he have made it that long without her? And of course, as has been said in many articles, this is a model of the parsonage. She was a pioneer of the new Reformation understanding of the Christian life, that all Christians are called to discipleship. That says Timothy Lowell, president of Pacific Lutheran Seminary. Katerina, an ordinary saint, teaches the challenge of discipleship in the world of every day. She brought a human element to Luther's theology, says a church history professor in Boston, a human element. He called her the morning star of Wittenberg, because she got up at the crack of dawn to get all of this done. Really a remarkable woman.
Who were you,
I think we'll let it go at that, but I hope I've teased you with wanting to read a little bit more about her and maybe listen to Bainton's tape or some of the other things. I'm returning this old book to the library, 1890. It's interesting. If somebody wants it. And this is available in the bookstore. I'm far from the top. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.